Okay, I'm going to move on to talk about normativity in language now. We will approach this topic from the direction of Kripke's skeptical paradox. Kripke sets up a skeptical paradox and offers what he calls a skeptical solution to it. But, as is often the way with these things, a number of people have found the paradox rather more powerful than the solution. They've been dissatisfied with Kripke's own solution. So the paradox has attracted a great deal of discussion and alternative solutions have been offered to it. So let's set out what the paradox is. It's supposed to be an attack on the whole idea of linguistic meaning. So the skeptic who is propounding the paradox is aiming to undermine the idea that our words have meaning. Or rather, to put it slightly more technically and precisely, that there's no fact of the matter about what we mean by our words and what our words mean. That reformulation will be important. So Kripke's skeptic argues, or is aiming to reach the conclusion, that there is no fact of the matter constituting my meaning one thing by a word as opposed to something else. And generalising that there's no fact of the matter about what our words mean. The argument proceeds epistemologically. Kripke, or rather his skeptic, argues that there's no fact which justifies my having any confidence that I mean one thing rather than another by a word. I can't justify any claim that I might feel like making about what a word means when I use it. I can't justify any confidence that I might pre-theoretically have about the meanings of my words. So it starts off in that epistemological way about what I can know, what I can justify. But it's aiming at a metaphysical conclusion, and the way it works is by arguing that even under ideal conditions of epistemic access, so even under conditions in which I have epistemic access to all relevant facts, even under these conditions, nothing can justify my claim to mean one thing rather than another by a word. And from there, the skeptic moves to the metaphysical conclusion that nothing can constitute my meaning one thing rather than another. There can be no fact of the matter about what I mean by my words. It can't be a matter of fact that I mean something particular by my words as opposed to something entirely different. Now, normally, arguments that proceed from epistemological premises concerning what you can know, to metaphysical conclusions concerning what there is, how the world is, normally these arguments are thought to be fallacious. And I think normally they are fallacious indeed. And the most famous historical example of that is the argument that Descartes advances for the real distinction, which, if you recall, proceeds along the lines of, I can doubt whether I am an extended thing. I can't doubt that I'm a thinking thing. I'm certain of that. And so Descartes concludes, it's not essential to me that I am an extended thing, whereas it is essential that I am a thinking thing. Because I can't, as it were, think of myself as a non-thinking thing, that status as a thinking thing gets to be part of my very essence. Whereas, because I can, allegedly, think of myself as a non-extended thing, then extension can't be part of my essence. So we're moving there, and this was something that one of Descartes' critics, Arnauld, pointed out. We're moving there from epistemological premises, premises about what you can know, what you can think of, what you can imagine, that kind of thing, to conclusions which supposedly establish what there is, how reality is, whether you are essentially a thinking thing or not. And that's normally regarded as a fallacious type of argument. In the case of the Descartes argument, that would be because even if it's true that you can imagine thinking away your extension of your body, so in other words, thinking of yourself without extension, even if it's true that that's imaginable in some sense, it might still be the case that having an extension is essential to you. It may be that imagination isn't a good guide to what's essential and what isn't. So in general, that form of argument is not reliable. However, in the present case, that objection doesn't seem to apply because of the involvement of ideality. So remember that Kripke's skeptic is saying that I'm allowed to help myself to ideal conditions of epistemic access. I'm allowed access to any facts that I want to have access to. And even under these conditions, says the skeptic, I won't be able to find a fact that justifies my confidence that I mean one thing rather than another by a word. And then it is plausible, I think, to say, well, if there are no circumstances in which you can get access to something which would justify that confidence, then it seems that the confidence can't be justified in a metaphysical sense, in the sense that there just isn't any fact of the matter. There's just no possible justification for your confidence that you mean one thing rather than another. And if there's no possible justification, then it seems a reasonable step from there to say, well, then it simply can't be a fact that I mean one thing rather than another. Because you'd expect facts about meaning to lie on the surface in the sense that they ought to be available to us. You'd have thought that we ought to have access to facts about meaning and be able to justify claims about meaning. Meaning shouldn't be something that is inaccessible to us. That's at least the background thought, and it's quite a natural one in this particular case, as I say, even though it's not in general true that for something to be a fact, you have to be able to know it. There are facts that are inaccessible to us, we normally think. There are some domains in which we're not comfortable with the idea of inaccessible facts. I mean, another example would be the moral domain. It would be odd to say that there were moral facts which we simply couldn't find out. And that's because we think of the moral domain as, in some sense, a human construct. It's, in some sense, we're responsible for it ourselves. So you'd expect us to have access to all the facts that there are there. And similarly with facts about meanings. Again, we think of that as something of a human construct, language, a human invention. So you'd expect facts about meanings to be accessible to human beings and not to be in some way essentially hidden. So the form of the skeptical argument seems okay in spite of the fact that it takes a form which in other contexts would be a rather unreliable one. But in this particular context, I think it's much less controversial than it would be elsewhere. Okay, that's the overall form of the skeptical argument. I can't, even under ideal conditions of epistemic access, justify my claim to mean one thing rather than another by a word. And so there can't be a fact of the matter that I mean one thing rather than another. That's the argument. And then Kripke goes on to, having laid out the argument in that way, he goes on to give a concrete example to try and bring the argument to life. And he takes a particular word, the word plus, so symbolizing addition, and he gives an example in which the skeptic aims to dislodge our confidence that we know the meaning of this word, that there is a fact of the matter. And the claim is that even under ideal conditions of epistemic access, we can't establish what this word means, we can't justify any claim that it means one thing rather than another, so there can't be a fact of the matter about what the word plus means. And then the argument is supposed to generalize to all words because there's nothing special about the word plus in this context. It just counts as a word. Any other word would have done just as well. You could have run the example on any word. Kripke picks this particular example because it's nice. It produces a nice, neat, skeptical argument, but in principle you could use any word at all, that's the idea, and reach a similar conclusion. So in this respect, the word plus is supposed to be quite typical, and therefore if we can conclude something about language on the basis of considering this typical word, the thought is that the conclusion will apply generally, because it will apply to all words. Okay, so Kripke's skeptic is challenging my confidence that I know the meaning of the word plus. And we're supposed to imagine a calculation involving the word plus, which I have never performed before. I've only performed a finite number of additions in my life, so there will be some number, quite large number, or a couple of quite large numbers, which I've never added together. I've never performed the calculation there. And to make it easy, Kripke picks two quite small numbers. This makes the example unrealistic in the sense that most people will have performed calculations with numbers of that size, but it makes the example manageable. So we're to suppose that you've performed additions on numbers up to 56, say, but not on numbers larger than that. And then you're confronted with the task of computing 68 plus 57. What is the answer to that sum? So, as I say, by hypothesis, this is a calculation that you've never yet performed. Well, if you carry it out, you should get, we'll come back to that phrase, 125 as the answer. If you don't make a carrying mistake or something like that. So in our normal, according to our normal way of talking and thinking, we would say, well, the answer to that calculation is 125. And then the skeptic comes in and says, well, what justifies your claim that that is the right answer, in the sense that that is the answer which one should give if one's being true to the meanings of the words? And in particular, we're focusing on the word plus in there. So we've got the question, what is 68 plus 57? And the idea is that I do the calculation as I would normally do and get 125. And the skeptic comes along and says, well, what makes you so sure that that is the correct answer? Well, there are a number of things I would appeal to in that situation, but the one we're going to focus on, because the issue is really the same for all of them, so this is supposed to be a typical case, as I've said. One of the things I would appeal to is that I know the meaning of the word plus. I've learnt the meaning of the word plus. I learnt it at school. And even though, by hypothesis, I've never applied it to this particular pair of numbers, I have learnt how to apply it, how to do addition, so I now perform the calculation, and I'm being true to, I'm conforming to, the meaning of the word plus that I learnt at school. So I'm carrying on using that word in accordance with its meaning. That would be my claim. So part of my answer to the skeptic, at least my natural first-off answer, would be, well, I'm justified in making the claim that I do, because I'm being true to the meanings of the words in the question. The question being, what is 68 plus 57? In particular, the word plus is one that I know, I've learnt its meaning, and I'm applying that now when I carry out the calculation. I carry out the calculation in accordance with my knowledge of the meaning of that word, among other things. That would be something like, I think, my initial answer to the skeptic. Now, Kripke imagines the skeptic playing awkward here and saying, well, actually, I think The correct answer is not 125, but 5. That initially sounds, of course, bizarre. How could that possibly be the correct answer to that sum? But the skeptic has a little story to spin, and it goes something like this, that when you learnt the meaning of the word plus in the past, when you learnt the meaning of the cross symbol that we use to symbolise addition, the meaning that you were attaching to it was of a function that mimics what we think of as addition up to 56, on numbers, pairs of numbers up to 56. But beyond that, if you put in a pair of numbers that are larger than 56, this function simply flatlines, as it were, and delivers 5 as the output. So you're to think of a function that is defined for all pairs of numbers, as the addition function is, but differs from the addition function in what it delivers on large outputs, in particular outputs over 56. So any numbers up to 56, this deviant function agrees with addition on those, but after that, it simply churns out the answer 5 to any inputs. Now, you notice that, and Kripke observes this point, that, of course, in setting up the example like this, I'm assuming I do know what I'm talking about. The skeptic is assuming, we're all assuming that we know what we're talking about when we talk about the addition function and this deviant function. Of course, in the end of the day, as Kripke says, the rug is going to be pulled out from under our feet, and we're going to find out if the skeptic is correct that we didn't know all of these things that we thought we knew. But in order to set the puzzle up, we have to assume that we do. So I've been happily talking away there about addition, as though I knew the meaning and you knew the meaning of that word. And I've been thinking of the addition function in an intuitive way, in the way we all think of it, I suppose, as a function that is defined over pairs of numbers as inputs. And then I've been defining this deviant function on the back of the definition of the function of addition, because I've been saying that the deviant function, and Kripke invents a special name for it, he calls it quaddition, this deviant function agrees with addition on numbers up to 56, but diverges from it thereafter in the way explained. Now, let's symbolize this deviant function by a star. Then we can define the quaddition function as x star y equals x plus y, where I use the usual cross sign for addition, if x and y are less than 57, but otherwise x star y equals 5. If you look at the lecture notes, you'll see that definition set out. And again, as I say, we're assuming here we know what we're talking about. We're assuming at this stage that we know the meanings of our words. And the skeptic is posing the skeptical puzzle in a way which does presuppose that, although, as I said, in due course, the rug is going to be pulled from under our feet. And the way that the skeptical puzzle arises in those terms is as a challenge to justify my confidence that by the English word plus, I really do mean addition and not quaddition. So I really do mean that cross function and not the star function. How do I know that when I learnt the meaning of the English word plus at school, how do I know that I wasn't learning the star function, that I wasn't being taught to associate that word with the star function rather than the cross function? And remember, of course, the artificiality of the example. Obviously, at school, one performed additions on numbers much larger than 56, but that's just an artificiality of the example to make it more manageable. We're to suppose that in reality the skeptic is defining this deviant function so that it agrees with addition up to very, very large numbers and only diverges after it gets to a point beyond which you've ever computed. And it could indeed be beyond a point which the entire human species in its entire history ever computes. But let's keep it simpler than that for the moment and keep it personal and individual. We're supposing that this function is defined in such a way that it diverges from addition at some point beyond the largest number that I've ever handled in computations. Okay, so how do I know that it wasn't this deviant star function that I was learning when I learnt how to, as we say, add? How do I know that I wasn't really learning how to quad, not how to add? Well, Kripke considers a number of responses that you might make to the skeptic here, a number of candidate answers that you might give for facts that might justify your now saying, oh no, I really did mean addition and not quaddition. So these would be facts that you could appeal to which would constitute your having meant addition in the past and having really learnt that function, as opposed to having meant quaddition and having learnt that function. Okay, so you, the skeptic is allowing you to appeal to facts which, as we said, you're allowed to appeal to any facts at all. So the idea is you should obviously select facts here that you think are favourable to your case against the skeptic, and you will select facts that you think can be appealed to as having constituted your meaning and having meant in the past addition rather than quaddition by the word plus. And it seems to me the idea is best thought of in this way, that if you can appeal to something in the past which then constituted your having meant addition rather than quaddition by the word plus. So, for example, if you can appeal to something in the original learning situation when you were taught the meaning of the word plus, and you can point to that and say, well, that then constituted my learning the word plus so that it meant addition rather than quaddition, so my coming to associate the function addition with that word rather than the function quaddition. If you can point to that fact in the past, then the idea is that you can now simply appeal to that in the present. You can simply say, and now I remember that past usage. And I'm going to use the word in the same way now. I remember how I used it in the past. I remember what I meant by it in the past. I remember how I learnt it, for example, and what it meant, what the teacher meant by it when I learnt that word. And now I'm appealing to that memory, and I'm going to use it in just the same way now to compute 68 plus 57, this new calculation that I'm facing. I'm going to use the word in just the same way as before. And I can remember, I claim, how I did use it before and what I did mean by it. Okay, so I think that's the idea. And the skeptic is really challenging. It's not a challenge about memory. This isn't memory skepticism we're dealing with here. The skeptic, so skeptic is allowing, as we've said, that you can have ideal epistemic access. So your memory can be as good as you like. You can have absolutely perfect recall as far as the skeptic's argument is concerned. You remember precisely what went on when you originally learnt the word plus in the classroom. That's fine. So the point at which the skeptic is challenging you is at that original situation or any other past situation you might care to appeal to as justifying your present confidence that this is what you really mean by the word. So the first set of facts that you might appeal to, Kripke's skeptic imagines you appealing to, are facts about non-linguistic behaviour. So in other words, if you or if somebody had made a silent film of all your past actions. The film doesn't include things that you write down, so this is supposed to be past non-linguistic behaviour. A film of you, you know, going into shops and exchanging money for goods and services and so on. So applying arithmetic in real life, but we're to imagine at the moment that we're confined to non-linguistic behaviour. So we don't know, we don't have a record of what you said or wrote, just of what you did in a purely non-linguistic sense. Well, Kripke's skeptic has an easy task with that kind of fact. If you try to appeal to that as justifying your present confidence that you mean addition rather than quaddition by the word plus, the skeptic will simply reply, well, there's nothing in your past non-linguistic behaviour to justify that, because ex hypothesi, your past non-linguistic behaviour, or your past behaviour, dealt with numbers less than 57. So all of that behaviour was perfectly compatible with your having internalised the star function, the quaddition function, rather than the plus function. Okay? We see a film of you maybe going into a shop and buying something, but the sums involved, when we attach numbers to the transactions that are going on, the figures involved are all less than 57. So if that's all the behaviour we're looking at, and it's all the behaviour that we're looking at involves numbers less than 57, then there's going to be nothing in that to warrant supposing that you mean the addition rather than the quaddition function. Because as we're saying, it was all performed on numbers less than 56, or numbers less than 57, and on those numbers, the quaddition and the addition functions agree. They're the same function on those numbers, so that your behaviour looks the same whichever of those you're computing. 6 plus 15 yields the same output as 6 star 15. They are the same function on those numbers because the numbers are less than 57. So if we see you performing that calculation, there's not going to be anything in your non-linguistic behaviour to tell us which of those two functions, or indeed infinitely many other functions, you are computing. Then Kripke's skeptic allows you to consider a second set of facts. Widening the perspective now, we're allowed to include facts about past linguistic behaviour. So, for example, explicit instructions that you gave yourself, or that you were given by others, such as your maths teacher. And now, if I appeal to these, I might say to the skeptic, well, look, you know, if you just look at the past instructions I gave myself or I was given, it's clear that I meant addition and not quaddition. But of course, that isn't clear. The skeptic is going to come back with the same response because, again, the same fact kicks in, which is that the previous examples that you manipulated all involved numbers less than 57. So all the calculations you performed and that you were given instructions on were about numbers less than 57. So the teacher taught you the addition rule, but the manipulations, the calculations that were used in that teaching process were all on small numbers, numbers less than 57, ex hypothesi. So you didn't get any practice on applying the function to larger numbers. And so you weren't given any explicit instructions, okay? And you didn't give yourself any explicit instructions about how to apply it to larger numbers. Nobody said to you, oh, well, if you're going to calculate, you know, 80 plus 70, then this is how you do it and this is what you'll get. No. And so the demonstrations were compatible with all sorts of extensions, an infinite number of different extensions, different functions, proceeding in different ways after the point has been reached, the point of the number 56, the upper limit of what the examples cover. Now, of course, you might say, okay, so the teacher only gave me calculations using small numbers, but all the instructions I received on how to add, on the techniques of adding, you know, carrying numbers and all of that, there was always an implicit or explicit instruction accompanying these calculations to the effect that this is how you do it. I'm showing you on small numbers, but of course you just do the same on larger numbers. The actual size of the numbers you're computing with doesn't really matter. This is the technique you're learning. and once you've mastered it on the smaller numbers, you can apply it automatically to the larger ones. That was the kind of implicit instruction or explicit instruction that you received. But that's not going to help you against Kripke's skeptic, precisely because the question at issue is precisely what going on in the same way on larger numbers amounts to. See, if the function you were really learning was the star function, the quotient function, then going on in the same way when you get to numbers larger than 56 would mean giving the answer 5 as the result of any calculation involving two of those larger numbers, because that was the function you were learning. So when the teacher showed you how to, in quotes, add on small numbers and then said, well, and now you go on in the same way when you get to large numbers, that doesn't actually tell you what you have to do, according to the skeptic, because it depends what going on in the same way amounts to. And that depends on which function it is that you're actually learning. Essentially, any move you make at this point, the skeptic can respond to by producing deviant interpretations of crucial words. So even if you imagine the teacher's read Kripke and says explicitly to you, look, I'm going to sort this skeptical puzzle nonsense out before you get into it at a later stage. So when I say you go on in the same way, I mean that. And now what's the teacher going to say? Suppose the teacher gives us as an example 68 plus 57, the very example we're considering, as an example of a larger calculation than one you've ever performed. And the teacher takes you through it and shows you how to get 125 as the answer. And the teacher then says, right, well, that settles that. You know that the answer to that computation is not 5 or anything silly like that. It's 125, and you got that by applying the rules I've taught you in exactly the same way to these two new input numbers as you did to previous examples. So nothing changes with the larger numbers. You just apply the same technique. Suppose the teacher did take you through that. That wouldn't settle anything. It might settle the answer to that particular computation. But as soon as we move to a larger computation, as soon as we shift the example to one that is larger than you've ever encountered before, or that the teacher mentioned, we face exactly the same problem. What is going on in the same way in this particular case? Maybe it's giving the answer 5. Maybe that is going on in the same way. Maybe that's what the teacher really meant. And even if we insert even more explicit instructions into the teacher's patter, like, by the way, at no stage when you do larger calculations does the function flatline and output a silly answer like 5, even there, the skeptic will be able to produce deviant interpretations of those words, or one or two of them will be enough, so that in this new situation that you confront, the word actually does mean that, in fact, you should output 5 as the answer. Because that's the sense implicitly, according to the skeptic, that was the sense it was implicitly being given. I mean, in a sense, you can get a hang of what's going on here and make it seem less strange if you sort of think of it in more general terms in this way, that any instructions at all have inexplicit elements. You can never give completely explicit instructions that cover all eventualities. Okay, so, if you imagine a parent saying to a child, right, I'm going out now and you're to stay in the house and under no circumstances are you to leave the house. Okay, perfectly clear instruction. Well, suppose there's then a fire, so the child leaves the house. Now, if you said to the parent, well, look, what do you think about that? Charles disobeyed your instruction. That was pretty reprehensible, wasn't it? No, of course, the parent's going to say, well, obviously, I didn't mean you know, don't leave the house even if there's a fire. That's a different situation. I meant under normal circumstances, the normal predictable circumstances that we are likely to confront, don't leave the house. But obviously in an abnormal situation, if there's a fire or a bomb or something, then all bets are off and the child has to use its own discretion and make a judgment about what to do. And that's going to be true about any set of instructions. So the skeptic will simply say, look, it doesn't matter what the teacher said to you explicitly about what you do in these and these circumstances. Sooner or later, you are going to confront numbers that are larger than ones that you've ever computed with. You're going to come into new situations. And I, the skeptic, am asserting, and I'm challenging you to rebut this, that these new circumstances are abnormal. In a way, that's the wrong way to put it, because the skeptic is precisely claiming that this is normality, but normality is different from the way you thought it was. But okay, if we put it in your terms, then this is an abnormal situation. You should be doing this in this situation, not that, even though that is what you might naturally be inclined to do. So the general point there is, no matter what explicit instructions you gave yourself or you were given, these can always be subject to a deviant interpretation, as we might say. The skeptic can come up with some cunning way of understanding those instructions so that in fact they mean you should give the answer 5 in this new situation and not 125. And the challenge is to say, well, you know, where does the skeptic go wrong there? How can I refute that? How can I say, well, that's not what I meant. That's not what the teacher meant. What can I point to that justifies my confidence? So the problem recurs, really. And if you appeal to more words, more instructions that you gave yourself or that the teacher gave you, then the skeptic just runs the same line again and says, well, look, I'll just offer you a deviant interpretation of those words. What makes you so sure that going on in the same way meant doing this as opposed to doing that? Maybe doing that's going on in the same way. Okay, then the skeptic considers a third group of facts that you might want to appeal to, namely facts about your mental history. And this subdivides into two species. First of all, Kripke's skeptic considers appealing to a mental image that you might have had, a mental picture that you might have had. And it's at this point that Kripke, who takes himself to be expounding a line of thought in Wittgenstein, it's at this point that he's really closest to Wittgenstein, because Wittgenstein, in his later work, polemicizes very strongly against the Lockean tradition of meaning, according to which understanding a word is having a mental image. And the gist of Wittgenstein's argument, which he goes over many times, is that having a mental image is neither necessary nor sufficient for meaning, for understanding. To understand a word, it's not necessary to associate it with a mental image. It doesn't matter if your mind is blank in that sense. So long as you use the word correctly, that's all that matters. It doesn't matter whether you have a little mental picture when you hear the word or not. And it's not sufficient either, because even if you do have a little mental picture, that little mental picture doesn't tell you how it should be applied. And this is the skeptical point, in a way, coming in again. If you try to fix the meaning of a word by appealing to a mental picture, that's just like appealing to another word to fix its meaning. And so the skeptic will say, well, that's a useless move, because I don't know how to interpret this other word either. So that's one set of facts that you might appeal to, and that, as I say, Kripke dismisses on those Wittgensteinian grounds. But he also mentions the possibility that you might appeal to a sui generis mental state. That's to say, sui generis means of its own sort. So a mental state which is not like a mental picture. It doesn't have any particular phenomenology associated with it. It's a state of understanding, and there's nothing much more that you can say about it. It's of its own sort, as I said, so that it's a unique kind of mental state, a state of understanding. And so the idea here would be that you simply stonewall the skeptic by saying, well, look, I simply do remember that I meant addition, not quaddition, by this symbol. I remember what mental state I was in, and it was this particular mental state, the one of understanding the plus sign as addition, as opposed to the other one that you're suggesting, or any other one, in which I understood that sign in a deviant way. I simply was in that mental state of understanding, and I now do remember that. So could you respond to the skeptic in that very direct way? And Kripke's response to that is to say, well, he says the move is in a sense irrefutable, but that it leaves the nature of meaning wholly mysterious. In effect, as I said a moment ago, you're just stonewalling the skeptic. You're not really giving, as it were, a reasoned response. You're just, as it were, saying, well, look, I do know, and I did know, that this is what I meant. And that's it. End of story. There's no fact which, as it were, constitutes that. There's no separate fact which I can appeal to, which justifies or constitutes this first fact. But I can appeal directly to this fact that I did mean such and such by the plus sign, and that's now what I remember that I meant. And that involved giving the answer 125 to this new computation, not the answer 5. Because that's what addition applied to this example yields, and I remember that I was in the mental state of grasping the addition function and associating it with this particular cross sign, and not your quaddition function. So, to say, Kripke thinks that this is a rather question-begging response. He doesn't really allow it for that reason. A number of commentators have, in effect, supported that response in the sense that they've said, well, you can't really answer the Kripke skeptic on Kripke's own terms, as it were, on the terms that Kripke sets up on behalf of his skeptic. Essentially, Kripke's skeptic is, as I've just been hinting, is asking you to appeal to a different sort of fact, not a fact about meaning or understanding, which can then be used to justify your claim to have a certain understanding, or can then be used to constitute your having meant something. So in other words, the complaint here is that the skeptic is in essence looking for some kind of reductive explanation of meaning and understanding. The skeptic says, well, how do you know you meant this by that word? And you're supposed to cite, you're allowed epistemic access to all facts, but the kind of fact you're supposed to cite is something else. You're supposed to point to something else. You're not supposed to say, I just remember that I did mean that, and that's all there is to it. That's regarded as a question-begging response. The skeptic is looking for something else which would not in itself just be the fact of having meant such and such by the plus sign, but a different sort of fact which could then be used as leverage, which could then be used to justify, to constitute the fact about meaning that we're looking at. And so, although Kripke himself doesn't allow this move, a number of commentators have said, this is a popular answer to Kripke's skeptical puzzle, well, we shouldn't expect there to be reductions of facts about meaning or understanding to other things. They're basic, they're primitive, they can't be reduced to anything else. And that is a response that, you know, you should give to the skeptic, that you just know that this is what you meant, and you just remember having learnt the addition function and not the quaddition function. And there's nothing else you can point to justify your assertion. Okay, Kripke spends some time considering a variant of the first answer. Remember, the first answer that was offered to you was to say, well, was to appeal to facts about past non-linguistic behaviour, and that was dispatched pretty quickly. But Kripke considers a variant of that in which you appeal not to overt behaviour, but to dispositions to behave. So a disposition is a way something is set up, as it were, or is structured or is constructed, which has consequences for the way it will behave in certain circumstances. Okay, so we talk about a glass as fragile, say. So fragility is a disposition. And what that means is that in certain circumstances it will break. If subjected to pressure, it will break. So fragility is a disposition. And the answer that Kripke is considering now is that you acquired a disposition when you learnt how to add at school, how to use the word plus and the cross sign. You acquired a disposition. So perhaps when you were taught the rule of addition, as we say, so when you were taught that word plus, you acquired a disposition to add and not to quat, to put it in the skeptic's terms. That's to say, you acquired a disposition which was such that when you reached the computation 68 plus 57, you would return the answer 125 and not the answer 5. That was simply the disposition you acquired. That was how you were wired up at that point. It's just a fact about your constitution, just as if, you know, just as it's a fact about the constitution of a wine glass that if I hurl it against the wall, it will break. So it was a fact about your constitution then, and it's still a fact now, that if confronted with this computation, 68 plus 57, you will in fact return the answer 125, not 5. So maybe you can appeal to that as justifying you're giving that answer and justifying your confidence that you learnt the addition rule, not the quaddition rule, and as what constitutes your having learnt that particular rule. Now, Kripke rejects this proposal on a very interesting ground, which has become very influential. What he says is that it confuses the descriptive with the normative. It confuses is and ought, to put it in old Humean terms. It gives an answer which tells us what you would do, not an answer that tells us what you ought to do. Now, why does that matter? Well, the thought is that when you learn the meaning of a word, you, as it were, enter into a contract to use the word in particular ways, in particular circumstances. So you undertake a commitment which is a normative one, which tells you how you ought to use the word. It imposes obligations on you. That's the idea. When you learnt the word plus, that was a transaction that imposed a certain obligation on you to use that word in certain particular ways and not in other ways. Right? There's such a thing as going right and going wrong when you use a word. You can use it correctly, you can use it incorrectly. That's the thought. That's what's meant by saying that it involves normativity. So Kripke's thought is that this answer to the skeptic is a kind of category mistake. It's delivering the wrong sort of thing. You know, it's like saying, and indeed I did pretty much say when I was describing the example a little bit earlier, that your response to the skeptic is, well, look, this is what I'm disposed to do. So this is what I meant. And I appeal to this disposition as in justification of doing this. But that sounds pretty circular. That sounds as though you're saying, I justify making this move because this is in fact the move that I'm making. My justification of making this move for making this move is that I'm in fact making it. This is how my disposition is playing out. Right, so you're in effect trying to justify what you're doing simply by appealing to the fact that it is what you're doing. And now normally we wouldn't count that as a justification in other contexts. And the way Kripke brings out what's wrong here is he considers two ways in which the dispositionalist, well, it's essentially one way, but he has two applications of it, in which the dispositionalist account goes wrong, where we can see how it goes wrong. And that is that you will have acquired, when you learnt the rule of addition, you will have acquired a certain disposition that is correct, so that when you're fed a computation, your body, your brain is so wired up that there is a particular answer you will give in particular circumstances. But, says Kripke, of course, That disposition, that complex disposition that you have acquired, will include dispositions to make mistakes under unfavourable conditions. So if you're very tired, for example, you've got a splitting headache, and I give you a very complicated addition to perform, you will quite likely make a mistake. Most of us do in those circumstances. So your dispositions include dispositions to go wrong. But so long as, and this is a subtlety which doesn't perhaps come out with sufficient clarity in Kripke's own discussion, because, I mean, you might say, well, if you acquired a disposition to go wrong, then you didn't really learn the rule, right? And that will be true in simpler cases. So if when learning the word plus, you acquired the disposition when confronted with 7 plus 3 to return the answer 11, then that really would mean that you were learning a different meaning, or misunderstanding, as we would say. You weren't learning the correct meaning of that word, the meaning the rest of us associate with it. That's a mistake, and it would have to be corrected. And, you know, one might well say, well, there you really were grasping a deviant function. I mean, there is a perfectly respectable mathematical function which, when inputted with 7 and 3, outputs 11, but it's not the addition function. And so if you return deviant answers in very easy cases, we would say that you hadn't yet grasped the rule, the one we're trying to teach you, which is addition. However, we don't take that draconian line if you return mistaken answers in unfavourable circumstances. So, as I say, situations in which you're under a lot of strain and where the computation is a very difficult one. There we are all prone to make mistakes, even though we do genuinely grasp the rule of addition. So we allow ourselves, to have grasped that rule, to have learnt that particular rule, even though when we learnt it, we acquired a disposition which included dispositions to make mistakes under certain circumstances. So long as those circumstances are sufficiently unusual, sufficiently unfavourable and so on, then they don't, as it were, undermine your right to have grasped that very rule, to be understanding the word plus. You count as understanding the word plus if you can perform calculations of the form x plus y in normal circumstances with reasonably small numbers. If you make mistakes in abnormal circumstances with very large and complicated numbers, that doesn't matter. Okay, you can still count as having grasped that particular rule. So what that shows is that your disposition is coming apart from your understanding. You have a disposition to make a mistake, right? But you do actually grasp the rule of addition. So your understanding is outstripping your disposition. It's better than your disposition. So if you're fed a computation of the form x plus y, we allow that you really do grasp the rule of addition, even though if x and y are sufficiently large and if circumstances are sufficiently unfavourable, you have a disposition to return a wrong answer. And as I say, so long as you don't do that in easy, normal cases, you continue to count as a genuine adder, as somebody who knows that function, has grasped that function. We don't say, oh, well, that person has really learnt, you've really learnt a deviant function, a kind of quaddition function. That's what you actually learnt, because look, this is what you're doing. So long as your deviant behaviour only arises in very abnormal circumstances and under situations of strain, then we allow that it doesn't constitute your real understanding. Your real understanding is better than your practice, as it were. But one can't say that, of course, about a disposition. Your disposition is revealed in your practice, right? Your disposition is a disposition to do whatever you do. Dispositions are not ideal, right? They don't have normativity built into them. You're just disposed to do what you actually end up doing, right? And if you don't behave in that way, then you didn't, in a particular way, then you didn't have the disposition to do so either. Right, so if I produce a wine glass and I say this glass is fragile, it's disposed to break, and then no matter what I do to it, no matter how hard I throw it against the wall or stamp on it or put it under a a roller or something. If it doesn't break, well, then it didn't have that disposition that I said it had. In fact, it wasn't fragile after all. So a disposition is just a state of being which causally outputs a certain type of behaviour in certain circumstances. And that's just a matter of how you actually do behave, or how the thing actually behaves. There's no oughtness about it. But Kripke's point is that in the case of meaning, there is an oughtness. You acquire an understanding of a word, and that has implications for how you ought to use it. And you go on counting as understanding that word, even if you don't use the word as you ought, so long as the circumstances in which you deviate from the rule are sufficiently abnormal. And of course, and this, in a way, is his clinching argument, and this is the second respect in which dispositions come apart from understanding. We are all finite beings, so we're all going to die. The human race is finite. It's going to die out at some point. So there are going to be computations, calculations, additions that are so large that nobody ever performs them, no matter how, even if the whole human species spent its entire existence doing larger and larger additions, still eventually it would die out and there would be even larger additions which it hadn't got to. And now we want to say, don't we, that, the rule itself, the rule of addition, as it were, that is an ideal object, and it does cover these computations that never get performed. So the rule that you learn way back in the primary school on small numbers, that very rule applies to vast numbers that are too large ever to be contemplated by human beings, and mechanically churns out an answer when two of those very large numbers are inputted. So we've got to think of it as an ideal, a Platonic object here, which gives an answer to a certain computational question, no matter how large the numbers that are inputted, and even though they're too large for any human being ever to get to. So there again, we want to say, and I think this is in a way Kripke's clinching point, that our understanding outstrips our practice and our dispositions. And here I mean our, quite literally. The whole of the human species has an understanding of the rule of addition, has a grasp of the rule of addition, so an understanding of the word plus or its translation into other languages, which outstrips any kind of practice with that rule, with that word, and necessarily does so because the rule applies infinitely. It applies over an infinity of input numbers, whereas the human beings and the whole human species is finite. So if you want to allow, and we're getting quite Platonistic here, but if you want to allow that we really do grasp the rule of that particular rule of addition and not some deviant quaddition style rule, the rule that outputs the sum of numbers and not some deviant function, even on numbers that are so vast that nobody will ever contemplate them, if we want to allow that we nevertheless do grasp that particular function, then we can't associate understanding, we can't identify understanding with any kind of disposition that an individual or indeed that the entire human species acquires. Somehow our understanding is ideal and reaches beyond our actual practice. So Kripke argues that none of the candidates that he's presented, and these have been what he takes to be the most plausible candidates for something that could constitute my understanding, none of these work as justifications for my claim to mean one particular thing rather than something else by my use of a word. So it seems as though there's nothing I can appeal to, if the skeptic is right, to justify my assertion that when I used the cross sign, the plus sign in the past, I meant addition as opposed to quaddition. And nothing I can appeal to that would constitute my having meant addition rather than quaddition by that sign in the past. So nothing I can appeal to now in justification of my present behaviour, my present intentions. And as we said before, this is just supposed to be a typical word. There's not supposed to be anything special about the word plus. We could have run the argument on any word at all. Indeed, as you noticed, at one or two points in the debate, I appealed to the fact that the sceptic can and will apply the argument to other words if necessary. So the argument generalises to all words and all speakers, which means that, as Kripke says, that the rug does finally get pulled away, although we've been assuming all along that we, as it were, knew what we were talking about in setting up the sceptical puzzle. Ultimately, of course, if the sceptical argument works, then it seems as though meaning simply evanesces, and we reach what Kripke calls the incredible and self-defeating conclusion that all language is meaningless. It's a self-defeating conclusion because here I am stating it in what we take to be meaningful language, and yet the conclusion is that language is meaningless. But it nevertheless, although something must be wrong with the sceptical argument, assuming that I am talking meaningful words, the question is what? We have to find a mistake in it. And that is what Kripke and others have attempted to do. I've actually indicated how some people argue against Kripke's sceptic by accepting one of the candidate facts, namely the sui generis mental state. So not everyone is happy with the way Kripke's sceptic disposes of the opposition. That's an understatement. Most people are unhappy with it for one reason or another. But I'll stop there for the moment, and then in the next lecture I'll talk about Kripke's own solution, his sceptical solution to the problem, and maybe say a bit more about the dispositionalist strategy that I mentioned briefly.